This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Al Letson didn't set out to make a radio show. He was a playwright and spoken word poet traveling all over the country. About 5 years ago, he entered the public radio talent quest. He was one of two picked from a pool of more than 1,500. The prize? His very own radio program. He started the State of the Reunion 3 years ago, and it's still going strong. The program examines regions, cities, and towns to see how they create community, places like Appalachia.
From PRX and NPR, I'm Al Letson, and you're listening to State of the Reunion. Rural Appalachia is often portrayed as a place of poverty, of victims. But this region is filled with people fighting for their families, their way of life, and their land.
We look at our Appalachian Mountains like we think it's a really bad sin of a man destroying God's creation. And that's what they're doing.
Coming up on State of the Reunion, we go to the hollers of Appalachia.
And while Al reports on the communities around America, he is also part of a storytelling community. He's been a frequent contributor to The Moth, where people tell stories to a live audience. And he's here in North Carolina to take part in The Moth event tonight at the Carolina Theater. Al Letson joins us in the studio. Great to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to be here.
You've been doing The Moth for a few years now. How is doing The Moth, which you prepare for, it's an event, it's a theatrical event, how's that different from producing a radio show?
It's night and day. I'm the boss, and so I have to coordinate a whole bunch of different things and producers and locations and all that stuff. The Moth is just pure love. They call me up and say, hey, we've got a gig. Do you want to come out? And I always say yes, pretty much. And then I go and I work with somebody on a story, and then we go put it up. And so I love doing The Moth. It's such a great experience. I love doing radio as well, but The Moth is a lot of fun.
Storytelling, I would think, has to be an element in common.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that you know, I was talking to somebody today, and they're like, you have too many jobs, and they're totally right. But the thing that all my jobs have in common is that it's about storytelling, because that's what I am. You know, I like to think that I am a digital age storyteller that does a little bit of everything. So, you know, in my radio show, I think that what we do is we tell the new American story, basically, that you don't really get to hear a lot. And so we do that, and then what I do in The Moth tends to be more personal stories. And then the plays that I write are also, you know, storytelling as well.
The theme or topic tonight is Between Worlds. Mm-hmm. Give us a preview. What are you going to be talking about?
Sure. I am, I don't want to give away too much, but I am telling a story about, I was 23 years old and I found out that I had a 6-year-old son living all the way across the country. Which was quite a surprise for me because I had never been in that part of the country. So it's the story of reconciling those two worlds.
Oh, that'll be great. So, but in this whole business of storytelling, you said earlier, telling stories, new stories about America, but in a sense that we don't often hear. Mm-hmm. But in when I listen to your program, it seems to me these are old. They haven't been told, mm-hmm. but they are old stories, and they are stories that go way back, and we haven't heard them, and we haven't told them.
Yeah. I mean, I think that I don't think there's anything new under the sun. I think that the type of stuff that I'm doing right now has been, you know, obviously you got to give a lot of credit to Charles Corral. And what he was doing, because that's basically similar to the type of stuff that we do. But when I think about a lot of the shows that I hear, whether it's, you know, say All Things Considered, and then on the other end of the spectrum, you've got stories like This American Life. What my show does is kind of like work that middle, where it's storytelling, but it's also reporting and the way we kind of bring it together. And so that's a little bit new and different. But yeah, I mean, these stories that we're telling, like the story about Appalachia, those stories are as old as the mountains. And, you know, our thing is that there's, you know, we live in challenging times. And I think that we tend to get caught up in the fact that we live in challenging times and it's doom and gloom. But the beautiful thing is that, like, all around us, there are people who are figuring out how to get through these challenging times. And so that's what we focus on. We look at, you know, yeah, there are things that are really hard right now, but all around us, people are figuring it out. And that's what we focus on.
You talked about being a storyteller in the digital age, and yet you made reference to Charles Corral and, of course, the kind of historic qualities of storytelling. What's different about it? What has the digital age changed for you as a producer?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it gives me the ability to stretch out a little bit. I mean, you know, 20 years ago, me doing radio the way I do it now, there's no way in the world I could have done it. I have producers that live all over the country. And we work kind of basically through phone and internet and sending stories back and forth to each other and shaping it that way. So that's one aspect of it. I think that what's great about this new kind of digital world we're into is that it's a great equalizer. You know, I am a small little show, but yet I'm able to compete with really big shows that are, you know, doing these mass productions. And so, you know, it gives me the ability to be agile and move around quickly. So I think that it's just another, you know, tool in the kit.
What do you think has changed to allow the kind of storytelling you and Ira Glass do? I will tell you just by way of context that I know Ira and worked with him back when we both worked at NPR, and we were both working on All Things Considered. And we would complain bitterly about the kind of the five W's and how being the only measure, the only way to recite the story. And Ira constantly chafed against that and said, there's a different kind of storytelling. Mm-hmm. And frankly, back then, I'm talking about the 1980s, not that long ago, nobody would listen. We can't do it that way because we've got this kind of rigid sense of journalism. Now he tells the story. Everybody takes it as journalism. Your program as well understands there's this broader, more artistic way or a way of telling stories. In addition, what do you think has changed?
Well, I think you just named it. I think Ira is what changed it. Ira is just an amazing individual, and you know, he had a great station supporting him, and he went out with a vision, and they pushed through, and they created a really great program that I think completely shifted the way public radio thinks about telling stories, and so and it gives it room, and so, you know, I really stand on the shoulders of Ira Glass and you know, programs like Radio Lab and so forth and so on, because they have changed the way, for lack of a better term, the gatekeepers in public mm-hmm. radio think about the possibilities of what can happen audio wise. So I think that, you know, that is the number one key, is This American Life kind of changed the entire landscape.
How about you were a poet and a playwright. Did you always aspire to be a radio producer? When did that idea enter?
No, I never aspired to be a radio producer. I had an idea. I always had an idea about what, you know, like I am a NPR junkie. Obviously, I think that like most of your listeners, you listen to NPR and you think, gosh, if I had an opportunity, I would do this. So that was in my head, but I never thought that I would ever have the opportunity to pursue it. And one day I was watching American Idol with my daughter, which I never do.
That's a public radio thing. Oh, you never watch that.
No. Look, I will totally cop to the fact that I'm a nerd, and like I can tell you all sorts of things about Superman and Wolverine, right. but American Idol is not in my purview. But you know, I'm hanging out with my daughter, and so she wanted to watch it. And at the end of it, like a day or two later, I wanted to know who won that contest. So because I don't know this stuff, I Googled it, you know, just to figure out where to find it out. I find out about it. And the first thing that popped up was NPR's American Idol. And I really thought it was going to be a folk singing competition. But I like, hey, I like folk music. Let's see. So I clicked on it and there was a contest. And the one thing I do on top of everything else I do is I'm a competitor. Like if I see something that I can compete in, I just go all out. So I competed and I ended up winning. And I got to make the show that I've always dreamed in my head. And actually the show that I was dreaming in my head, in the actuality of doing it, it's so much better than what I had in my head. Because this country is, it's so amazing to me in a way that I think that I thought I had a little window into, but now that I'm like on the road and going out and meeting people nonstop, I'm just I'm so blown away by this country.
What is changed for you in your understanding about the way these communities act and the people who are?
Sure, I think that, you know, we tend to live our lives in the place that we're rooted in. So for me, it was Jacksonville, Florida, and Jacksonville, Florida, for me, represented the United States. And so, you know, the people in my community, they basically, in my head, subconsciously, you know, that was what America is. And it's when you get out and you travel places and you see that there are, you know, America is just so diverse, not just in its people, but in the land as well. And so when you go out and you actually see these things, it changes you. And you see how people live on the ground and how their concerns can be so different from yours. But yet there's something that holds you all together that has this commonality to it. I was in Española, in New Mexico, in the Española Valley. And, you know, for them, like, a big thing is water. It's really big out there. I live in Florida. Like, water, I'm not worried about water. Like, it comes from the sky a lot, you know.
Way too much, right?
Exactly. So, but talking to them, like, really helped me understand a world that I wasn't a part of, you know, and helps me understand this country a little bit better.
Yet, that said, it really wasn't necessarily being a show producer whose mission is to discover the communities of America that helped you discover. You were a flight attendant. You got to get around, right?
I did. And, I think that, like I said, like I feel like being a flight attendant and performing and doing all that stuff, first of all, it gave me great stories for the Moth. Secondly, it did. It gave me like a little bit of window into America. But what I do now in radio is like a deep dive. Like we research a place for months on end. Then we're there for a week to 2 weeks. And so, you know, that is a really concentrated view of like what a place is and how it works.
You, as a flight attendant, though, weren't necessarily, because of the airline I guess you were working for, not going to some of the more glamorous places on the map.
No, I have been to Killeen, Texas, and Lubbock, Texas, and all these little cities more than probably anybody should have to. You know, they're lovely cities, but not where I want to spend a lot of my time.
And in this storytelling, and getting back to this, what we lose when we only do the five W's and how, and we need to do that. You need to report the data and get the news out. Tell us what Congress is up to, what the president said today. Need it all. But in only telling that story, there are these, it seems to me, all kinds of, and I'll call them movements, that are happening, that are working over and against some of these dominant narratives that could surprise you in terms of outcome. I mean, do you have that feeling?
Absolutely. I think that, in this new season, for example, with State of the Reunion, we are doing an episode on Tucson. And there's a story in Tucson about banned books and how they had banned Latino culture in schools. And I went out to Tucson, you know, with this thought about what the story was. But then when I got out there, I realized that the story is completely different. And every time it's been reported, you know, people said what needed to be said, and no one was lying, I don't think. But it's the nuance. It's the things that happen in between that gap. You know, like one of the things that wasn't being reported on is the fact that a lot of the people that were against these programs were Latinos, which really kind of changes the way I thought about it all together. I was like, wait a second, wait. Because at the time, I was thinking, well, this is all in reaction to Arizona's new immigration law. And so that's the frame of reference I went into. But then when I got there, I realized it was a completely different thing, and that the sides on this had morphed, and people who probably wouldn't be working together in your typical situation were actually working together on this issue. And so all the time I see that like the thing that rises to the top is the big questions and the big stories. But everything that's under it, all of that stuff that kind of cooks it, is what's important. You know, that is what America is.
And that's when you have to be open to the idea that the people in it and the subjects of your story are not stock characters.
Absolutely.
Who get to play the conservative. Absolutely. And the liberal, and here's how the Latino and the African-American community can look at this.
There's a poet that I love. His name is Taylor Molly. And Taylor Molly has this poem. And at the end of it, he says, "The best way to know you have a mind is to change it." And whenever I think about what I'm doing, I am pretty open with the listeners that, like, I have a way of seeing things, but I go into a situation being very open to my mind being changed and looking at different perspectives. And that's what I see all around the country, is that things change.
How did you get interested in spoken word and in playwriting?
You know, when I was young, when I was in high school, I thought I was going to be the next Puff Daddy. That was my goal. And I guess right around the time when I graduated high school, I really kind of fell out of love with hip hop. And for many years, I felt like, you know, for like 3 or 4 years, I felt like I was an artist without an art. And I wanted to express myself, but I didn't know how. and the magic of public media. Bill Moyers had this special called The Language of Life. It came out in 1994, I think. And it was the Geraldine R. Dodge Poetry Festival, and they were playing poets and interviewing poets. And they interviewed this one poet. His name is Sekou Sundiata. And his poem was amazing. Everybody's poem was amazing. But what got me was his interview. And he said that when he was a kid, he heard Amiri Baraka do a poem, and it was called Go On With Your Bad Self. And in that poem, he realized that his everyday language, what he said on the street with his buddies, could be used in poetic fashion, and that was empowerment for him. And I remember driving in my car, listening to the tape, and like literally I felt like someone had struck me with lightning. And I knew that, like, that's it. Like, I can write and I can talk about my experiences in a poetic fashion and reach out to people and make connections. And so from there forth, I just started writing really bad poems for many years.
Yeah. Got to write a bad play before you write a good one. Ibsen.
Listen, I had this writing instructor, and he told me, you have to write 100,000 bad words before you get to the good. I think I wrote about 500,000 bad words.
You really wanted to make sure.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. But, you know, it came about, and that's how I got in spoken word, and I did well in poetry slams and all that jazz. But then I got frustrated with the short amount of time, and most of my poems were kind of monologue-y anyway, and so that ended up me going into theater. And theater has been challenging and good for me.
What made you fall out of love with hip-hop? And I ask because, in a sense, what the message you got from that program is the subtext of hip-hop. Your language, your experience is art.
Yeah, it totally is. I think that where I started to fall out in love with hip-hop is that, you know, when I was coming up with hip-hop, it was kind of the golden age where you had people who were rapping and their lyrics were just amazing. And the older I got, the more I saw that lyrics wasn't necessary anymore to make a hit, and that, like, it was all this flashy stuff, things that just don't connect with me. Like, you know, I drive a minivan, you know, like, I'm not into the flashy cars and stuff. And so, like, I just felt kind of disconnected from the culture. And but, you know, look, I still buy a great hip hop album. If you listen to my iPod, iPhone, you'll find hip hop on there, along with Yo-Yo Ma, along with the Black Keys and so forth and so on. I listen to pretty much everything.
How has producing the State of the Reunion affected your art, or has it? Has it become the grist for membership?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's made me a lot of the theater that I do now is tends to be documentary in its basis. And so, you know, I work with these amazing, amazing producers, Tina Antolini and Laura Starchesky and Taki Telenidis. And you know, they have just taught me so much about journalism and interviewing and all of that stuff. And so it's definitely strengthened what I do as a storyteller, as a playwright, all of that. I feel like there are tons of struggles being involved in public media, as I'm sure you know. but I feel like I've just been so blessed and fortunate to have this opportunity and to be able to work with such great people that have taught me so much.
Can you give us a preview upcoming season?
Yeah. So as I told you before, I am a huge nerd. And being a huge nerd, I tend to read, like, all the nerd blogs. And I just started seeing all these great stories about comic book culture. And I felt I've been thinking for a long time that the concept of State of the Reunion is really strong, but we live in an age now where community isn't necessarily defined by geographic boundaries. And I thought this would be a great place to test that. Like, let's do a whole hour on comic books. And we did an hour on comic books, and I think it's one of our strongest hours yet. We have stories about, you know, people who don't even know, you know, another character, but because they're connected through comic books, they go through extraordinary measures to help each other out. So we've got that episode. We did an episode on southeastern Washington State, which there's a desert in southeastern Washington State.
Who knew?
Exactly. I had no idea, man. You know, so and I got to see the so my producer's going to kill me if I don't say this exactly right. I got to see the nuclear reactor that created the plutonium that went into Fat Man, the bomb that was dropped over Nagasaki.
Yeah. Wow.
Which was, to this day, I just don't have any words for it. because it's an amazing structure, but also dangerous.
Al, pleasure talking with you.
Yes, thank you very much.
The very uncool and yet very talented Al Letson, host of State of the Reunion National Public Radio Program, distributed by PRX and NPR. Coming up, he's going to be at the Moth tonight, 8 o'clock, Carolina Theater. For more information, carolinatheater.org, and the Moth event tonight, 8 o'clock. Up ahead, the Hermit of Fort Fisher. Stay tuned.